Reflect for a minute,
please.
God,
I missed you so much last week.
I listened in, and you. There were a few moments.
I was like, you know, this
I'm
is,
not the villain of the podcast.
Not the villain.
Just
the worst.
That is your word.
Just
I didn't
the worst,
say
that's
it.
All.
And so, you know, I think it's good we have three, and if, then
yeah.
there were three.
I would agree with that.
It's nice. It's good to be back. Yeah, sorry I had to miss last week, everyone.
It's okay, James. We all forgive you. I mean, I had to miss the week before. But I just wanted to acknowledge that we're all here.
Nick's giving that look that he does, and it's off-putting.
He knows we love him, so I don't know why he does that look.
Mm. Yeah. It's because he's on the other side of the table by himself.
Wearing a hoodie.
Got a lot of room.
With the hood on. Anyways.
We have an awesome interview.
Amazing interview coming up.
Yes.
One of my best friends in the whole world. Her name is Nicole Dalton, and she is, I call her goddess. That's what she is.
But
she's also an actress, a comic, and an advocate, and she is living and thriving with systemic juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. She's involved in the National Arthritis Research Foundation and Creaky Joints and all these other things. And so stick around to hear like from someone who is like in the weeds, in a lane, in the healthcare system. And also is good friends with Peter
Morley. Yes, Peter Morley. So if you enjoyed
big
that interview,
friend of
and
the
how
pod.
Yeah, he was very informative in that interview, and Nicole is very informative in this interview today. So stick around.
In their interim, can we just like whiz through some of this news?
Sure.
To get to the amazing interview.
So this week, I don't know how if we could actually whiz to the news. This is a lot of news.
There was a tremendous amount.
You know, it's funny we say that every week, but there was a lot.
No, but Thursday and Friday was like a
it was
waterfall.
Bang, 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 bang.
Bang, bang, bang,
bang, bang. Can't get up.
The week started with Jared Kushner losing access to top secret intelligence. This is from a political article from Ileana Johnson and Andrew Rusticia.
Hashtag downgraded. Beyonce, let's make a song about downgrade.
Presidential son-in-law and advisor Jared Kushner has had his security clearance downgraded, a move that will prevent him from viewing many of the sensitive documents to which he had once unfettered access. Kushner is not alone. All White House aides working on the highest interim clearances at the top secret /SCI level were informed in a memo sent Friday that their clearances would be downgraded to the secret level, according to three people with knowledge of the situation. The president has the ability to grant Kushner a permanent clearance, but Trump said Friday, the same day the memo was sent, that he was leaving the decision to his chief of staff.
That's an awkward dinner table conversation.
Yeah, we're learning that I think up to 30 people did not have top secret security clearance information and now have been moved down, hashtag downgraded. And Jared Kushner is now losing that as well. So there are very few people that apparently have top secret security intelligence access within the White House. And Jared Kushner, who's been tasked with fixing the Middle East, I believe fixing the opioid quote unquote epidemic, which we'll talk about with Nicole.
Yep.
Fixing what else? I don't know, the space program. I mean, Jared Kushner is...
They slated him
Mexico
to do all of
that. But he was prepared to fix.
Obviously, yeah, he was not prepared in any way. He was not qualified to be doing that. And
that's the thing. Yeah, that's the
you
thing.
Know, and so like, and so we shouldn't be surprised that all these foreign leaders... I mean, obviously, the big part of the reason he's losing this clearance is because he was viewed as someone who could be easily influenced by these other foreign nations. So like... If he was that big of a risk, he should not have been in that position
in the first place.
Well, and we'll talk about that in a second, some of the crappy stuff he's been doing. But Trump aide Hope Hicks to resign amid personal tumult and Russia probe. This is from a Washington Post article by Philip Rucker and Ashley Parker, where they write that Hope Hicks, the White House communications director and one of President Trump's longest serving and closest advisor, abruptly announced Wednesday that she plans to resign, sending a jolt through a West Wing besieged by internal tumult. Is that word
it's
again?
Funny when we read sentences like that, because I'm like, well, at this point, all that's been happening is jolts going through the West.
Jolts are just constantly.
People just constantly
also,
are leaving or getting fired.
This is, I believe, the next, well, who was it? There was Sean Spicer, Hope Hicks, What was his name? There was another guy, and then Scaramucci. So now he'll be on his fifth, I believe, White House communications director. It's like the defense against the dark arts position in Hogwarts. Mm-hmm. Never sticks around.
Nope.
I make a Harry Potter reference once a pod.
At least. Bare minimum.
Got a lot of potheads out there.
Boo.
You'll note that only Nick laughed at that joke.
I enjoyed it. I'm pretty tired.
He does look very snuggly and tired right now.
But I enjoyed that one. Man, I love Harry Potter.
I can't stand you sometimes.
So Hicks, 29, began working for Trump before he announced his candidacy, has been a trusted confidant for 3 years, shaping his image, managing his moods, and counseling him on nearly all matters, from the substantive to the trivial.
Managing his moods?
Which is interesting. I mean, I don't know where everyone else is at in their maturity development, but at 29, you know, I would say that is a large position.
To be the White House communications director?
Yeah,
one would agree. I mean,
all about, like, there's amazing, like, you know.
Yeah, Jon Favreau was 28 when he was the head.
Everybody was young, et cetera, et cetera. But, like, this is a very, erratic, unpredictable human.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's...
And, like, she's not been managing his moves,
I think.
I might say.
I do disagree a little bit on the age thing, though, because
yeah,
I think
no,
that there
I hear
are...
You.
Like, Jon Favreau was 28.
I was, like, thinking about it in my head.
Alyssa Mastromonaco, the love of this podcast's life,
was
32 when she was the deputy chief of staff when she first
yeah,
started.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, you're right. You're right. So, you're right. Like, I hear you.
Sorry, Nick's
but
just having
I'm
a
just,
moment.
I'm just, I think maybe I'm responding not to the age thing, but more like the scope of that position is like incredibly.
Well, she
huge.
Also definitely didn't have the credentials. She was a model.
And that's a recurring issue.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Not saying you can't be a model and then go on to great things, but you can't be a model and then become the communications director of the White House.
Yeah, right, there's a learning curve.
But that's
there,
the story of this administration, though. It's filled with people who are not qualified to be in the position that they're in. And that's, I don't know, are we talking about Ben Carson at all? Because that was a whole thing too.
Oh yeah,
week.
That yeah. Well, yeah.
I mean, it's not like a big deal, but the fact that, you know, the Secretary of Interior, you know, people were saying that, you know, he didn't want a chair that was less than like $5,000 because you couldn't get a chair that was good unless it was more than that. And it's like, why are you spending taxpayers' money on a chair when there are like actual houses
also,
that
like,
need to be
that's
built
insane.
For
As-
people?
As someone who runs a government building, mm-hmm. can I just say that you can sit in any kind of chair and it's fine.
And it's fine.
As long as it's not broken. Ding, ding, ding. I've had to throw away a lot of broken chairs. Anyways, back to the news.
It's interesting, too, that Hicks resigned at this time, even though she's denying it has anything to do with this. In the article, they write that her special relationship with the president has ensnared Hicks and special counsel Robert Mueller's wide-ranging investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 election and possible obstruction of justice by the president. She's come under scrutiny for, among other things, her role aboard Air Force One last year, helping the president draft a misleading statement about his son Donald Trump Jr.'s 2016 meetings with Russia, like Natalia Veselnitskaya. Hicks has been interviewed by Mueller's team, and on Tuesday she testified for 9 hours before the House Intelligence Committee as part of its separate Russia investigation. She admitted to telling what one person familiar with her testimony characterized as white lies. She told the committee that she sometimes stretched the truth on minor matters at Trump's direction, but said that she had never lied about anything relevant to the investigation, according to this person who spoke on the condition of anonymity because the testimony was confidential. So she goes into this House Intelligence Committee meeting where she testifies for 9 hours. She's been interviewed by Mueller's team, and then she abruptly resigns. I think it has everything to do with that, whether she says it or not. Mm-hmm. Which led Trump to start a trade war because he was so mad about Kushner, he was so mad about Hope Hicks, that he tweeted out, "Trade wars are good and easy to win," which is quite the opposite of truth. And he announced this trade war without anybody in the White House knowing.
Again, this things that have happened before, announcing things that no one else knows about.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys remember when Obama announced things that nobody knew about, that his team wasn't prepared to?
Yeah. Or even, we say, some other presidents.
No.
Do we remember?
What he announced were like cute things, like the puppies on the lawn. And like,
even the
and
big
thing. I might say that was probably his like social media coordinator being like,
right.
Look at Bo.
Barack
and
Obama.
Bo was like, boom, nailing it.
But it's interesting that, yeah, I mean, even other administrations, Republican administrations,
yeah.
Democrat administrations have never, in the White House, there is a game plan that goes into announcements.
Yes.
Everybody on the team has to be briefed on it. And everybody on the team has to know what's going on.
And the language around it is always really, you know, whether you agree with how it ends up or not, but it's always scrutinized, you know, internally to make sure that, you know, it's like parenting, presenting a united front, but across like the entire cabinet.
Right.
The entire mm-hmm. this.
And so when you announce things that you
have not told anyone about,
there are consequences, especially if you're the president of the United States, which the Dow closed more than 400 points lower after Trump says that steel and aluminum tariffs are coming. This is from Fred Impert at CNBC.com, where he wrote that stocks fell on Thursday after President Donald Trump said that the U.S. will implement tariffs on steel and aluminum imports next week. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed 420.22 points lower at 24,608.98 after rising more than 150 points earlier in the day. Uh-oh.
Yeah, I mean, the CEO, later in that article, it says the CEO of this analytics company said that this could really spook the market, of course, and the biggest wild card would be a trade war, and no one should be excited for that. And that's, I mean...
Well, and yeah. Europe, the European Union has responded very harshly to this.
Well, yeah.
And they are, it's interesting.
As well, they should.
No, but I was reading something, this is not an article that we have, but I was reading something that apparently when the European Union feels threatened, they will target specific things. So right now, the European Union, I think, is threatening attacks on bourbon, which the main exporter of bourbon in the United States comes from Kentucky, where the Senate leader is Mitch McConnell, is the senator of.
Oh,
and they're
Mitch.
Also targeting, I think, something else in Wisconsin. Jeez. Where Paul Ryan, I don't know. I don't want to say yes.
Yeah,
but Paul
let's not
Ryan,
play into the stereotype,
the Speaker
but
of the
maybe
House,
it is cheese.
Well, they do export a lot of
cheese.
Yeah,
they do.
So I think
delicious
it's really interesting
cheese.
That the EU has, they have their attacks now are specific on Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell's home
we
state.
We might say that is a juxtaposition between the lack of strategy happening here. You know, mm-hmm. that is
yeah, what
that's
incredible
what we label strategy.
Strategy.
That is.
You know?
But isn't it funny just like you hear things about that and just how other countries are so organized?
Well, that's not even a that's just like a
no,
a,
no,
you
no,
don't
no
even
union,
a
but
union
just like you hear
organized.
About like different. It's just like, you know, like the way that, you know, even Canada, you have Canada's health system. You've got I forgot what I was reading something else this week, but it's just like I read more and more articles just about how places organize, like how they handle crime, how they handle drug use, and like how things turn in a positive direction. Meanwhile, America can't get its shit together.
Yeah,
and it just seems to be going downhill the longer we exist.
Yeah. Speaking
That's
of countries
all.
Being very good at things, Russia is very good at infiltrating our security
yes.
systems and influencing
what
our elections.
What a transition!
Thank you. So, who wants to take this one? Anyone want to take this NBC
you
news
know,
article?
I'll take
I've been
it.
Talking
okay. Emily doesn't like Russia.
It's a hard topic.
It's a hard topic.
Maybe if you talked about it, you'd get through it. It'd be better. It'd be therapeutic. It'd be like cathartic.
It's an interesting idea. James?
That she's not
we'll
entertaining.
Right
All right. So this NBC News article by Katie Turr and Carol Lee. Mueller asking if Trump knew about hacked Democratic emails before release. So special counsel Robert Mueller's team is asking witnesses pointed questions about whether Donald Trump was aware that Democratic emails had been stolen before they were publicly known and whether he was involved in their strategic release, according to multiple people familiar with the probe. Mueller's investigators have asked witnesses whether Trump was aware for plans of WikiLeaks to publish these emails. They have also asked about the relationship between GOP operative Roger Stone and WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and why Trump took policy positions favorable to Russia. A line of questioning suggests that special counsel who was tasked with examining whether there was collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia during the 2016 election is looking into possible coordination between WikiLeaks and Trump's associates in disseminating the emails, which U.S. intelligence officials say were stolen by Russia. So it's just very interesting. Like, it's again, this is just another line of like, okay, we're getting closer. We're asking the questions. We're trying to get to the bottom of what's going on. I think the one notable thing we should look at is as WikiLeaks was strategically publishing stolen emails in the closing months of the campaign, Trump also publicly said he loved the group. He mentioned WikiLeaks 145 times during the last month of the 2016 campaign. In 2017, President Trump's CIA director Mike Pompeo would label the group a hostile non-state actor. So it's just very interesting that, you know, we've brought this up before, how Donald Trump Jr. had tweeted things that had popped up on WikiLeaks, and then like not only he was communicating, and then about 15 minutes later, Donald Trump himself tweeted out things about WikiLeaks. So, you know, there seems to be this constant trail. You know,
it really feels like I've been watching a lot of How to Get Away with Murder.
Oh, why?
It feels kind of like that.
And they've gotten away with murder.
I mean,
of our democracy.
That was a reach, but okay.
Well, what does it feel like? I thought that was the obvious answer.
Well, it just, because like, it's like, I feel like every episode of that show, it has like, there's like a hint at the beginning and then something happens and then it's always like, boom, circling back to the beginning 15 minutes later. Mm. And like, it just feels like really like there's a lot happening all the time. Mm. And it's a little like, I'm trying to draw the map of the characters in my head, and I'm like, this is getting very...
Is Viola Davis Putin in this situation?
Very. I don't think... It's not a direct analogy.
Okay, sorry.
No, just the process direct. Of, like, the murder yeah. and, the, and like, the details. Yeah,
and then
the
it's
details.
Like, and then we found something else. But well, that's actually related to this one thing that happened over here.
Well, look how it is, because, like, I feel like as we roll this news out every single week, you know, like, it seems like all the clues are just kind of laid out for us, but because of the way the justice system works and we have to go through the necessary channels, we can't just say, hey, he did it. You're like, you can, but there's like no legal action yet because we can't. Because
they need the whole.
They need
it's
the
so,
whole
it's
thing.
It's so fascinating too, because it's. We talk about this with Nicole about how there's so much paperwork and bureaucratic crap that goes into healthcare, mm-hmm. and it really in the legal system it's the same way. You know,
exactly.
I am a firm believer that regulations are good, but I think that sometimes we have all this red tape. Happening and yeah, it's just it's ridiculous.
Because look at anytime I see Vladimir Putin on TV, like he knows he did it. He knows he was involved in
yeah, meddling. We know
with
he
like,
did
we,
it.
Everyone knows.
Everybody knows.
But we just can't do anything about it
no.
yet.
Yeah.
And it's very frustrating.
Let's get into our favorite guy, Jay Kush.
Kushner.
Well, we said we come back and we talk about the shitty things he was doing, and we're at that point.
Let's do it. I'll read it. Boom. Kushner's family business receives loan after White House meetings. So this is by Jesse Drucker, Kate Kelly, and Ben Protes in the New York Times. But essentially, earlier last year, a private equity billionaire started paying regular visits to the White House. Interesting.
Interesting.
Joshua Harris, the founder of Apollo Global Management, was advising Trump administration officials on infrastructure policy. During that period, he met on multiple occasions with Jay Kush. Of course, President Trump's son-in-law and senior advisor said three people familiar with these meetings. Among other things, the two men discussed possible White House job for Mr. Harris. The job never materialized, obviously. But in November, Apollo lent, ready for this number, $184 million to Mr. Kushner's family real estate firm, Kushner Companies. Creative title. The loan was to refinance the mortgage on the Chicago skyscraper. Even by the standards of Apollo, one of the world's largest private equity firms, the previously unreported transaction, what, with the Kushners was a big deal. It was triple the size of the average property loan made by Apollo's real estate lending arm, according to security filings. And it was the largest loan that they received this year.
That's a lot
reactions,
of money
thoughts,
to also concerns. Not to also not document.
I yep. think that he's going to have a very rough couple months.
I mean, he's kind of already had it rough, but now he's just going to have it rough with the American legal justice system.
I mean, yeah, it's not great. And it keeps going to show that you shouldn't employ people with deep debt, deep financial ties, with familial ties. The nepotism is off the charts in this White House. They're literally breaking every single thing. Every single thing. Constantly.
Yeah.
But we have a lot of good news
we
this
do.
Week.
We do. We did a little deep dive into the good news. So
yes.
Thanks for joining us. And let's ride on this like rainbow.
All right. So this
James?
GQ article by Jay Willis.
One of our most upstanding publications. That we always
GQ support. Is great.
I know.
They have
I
great
love this
reporting.
Article. This article is great.
How dare you? How dare you, Emily? GQ is wonderful.
James?
I'm going to kick whoever that is off the podcast.
I don't know
like,
who that was.
Yeah,
I think Anna Wintour was on our podcast for a brief
moment. That
no.
is not how... No, 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 no.
She has a transatlantic accent. We need to talk about it.
Okay, she does.
She's
don't.
A queen.
You don't.
All right. Wow. Who knew that Anna Wintour would strike such a chord? Not,
do you... I mean,
not
we
all
are
the...
James and I are fashion icons.
How?
We clearly... I saw
how
her once. I saw her
dare
once.
You. Not
James.
Include me on that.
So let's get back to the podcast and some good
this
news.
This is outrageous. So, I've been attacked in a way that I never thought possible.
All right, so.
I have a Miranda Priestly
can
sweater.
Can you stop?
Okay.
Thank you. All right, so this article titled, How an Activist Group Turned to the Dark Side to Hit Breitbart Where It Hurts. It's like millions of Americans who watch in horror as a long, contentious, and
bigotry-filled
campaign season ended with Donald Trump winning his bid for the Oval Office. The group of friends behind Sleeping Giants were feeling, as one of them puts it, pretty, quote, bummed out in the weeks following Election Day 2016. But after it became clear that that former Breitbart executive Steve Bannon would be appointed to a senior position in the Trump administration, they decided to respond by doing what everyone does when they spot something bad in the world. Start tweeting about it. Less than a year and a half after Sleeping Giants, less than a year and a half after Sleeping Giants sent its first screenshot to a Breitbart advertiser, their model of polite, carefully targeted, crowdsourced activism has resulted in nearly 4,000 companies adding the site to their programmatic advertising blacklist. The group is called Sleeping Giants. They are on Sleeping Giants on Twitter. And you can also find them at Facebook, facebook.com/SLPNGGIANTS.
So that's Sleeping with no vowels, Giants.
Giants.
With vowels.
With vowels.
Giants has the vowels. The word Sleeping does not.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Sleeping Giants.
So yeah, check them out, guys. Because again, we always talk about like little bits of activism that we try to do in our daily lives. And this is a great way. And the fact that they got 4,000 companies at this point, that's huge. So give them a look at Twitter and Facebook.
The article is also really fun. So if you want to read that.
Speaking of high numbers and activism, Parkland student Emma Gonzalez has more followers than the NRA days after joining Twitter. Just days. This is an article in USA Today. Mary Bowerman, a high school senior who survived the mass shooting in Florida 2 weeks ago, now has nearly twice as many followers on Twitter as the National Rifle Association. She's become one of the most prominent voices calling for gun control legislation following the attack, which resulted in the death of 17 people in Parkland, Florida. She joined Twitter last week and has already amassed followers. And while that, you know, it's, we live in this world where it's like followers matter, but they don't matter, but they do matter. It's just a piece of information for us to, you know, see about people's priorities. And then also another Parkland teen survivor, David Hogg,
yep,
calls for a spring break boycott of Florida. This is an article.
It's a great idea.
Yeah, truly. It's an article in the Sun Centennial by Paula McCone. And this Stoneman Douglas High School student was the leader in the Never Again movement. Posted on Twitter, he said, "Let's make a deal. Do not come to Florida for spring break unless gun legislation is passed." And I think that's a really beautiful idea because it is one of those places where it's like, oh, I'm going to Panama City. Like, as someone that grew up in Georgia, like, it was like the spot, you know? And so I think that's a lot of income for the state too. Like, a lot of the state is, you know, vacation destinations and things like that.
Because I do want to point out, this is a tweet that was posted either yesterday or the day before, but the Florida Senate, they rejected a ban on AR-15s, which is the weapon used at this school shooting at Parkland. So there were 17 yays and 21 nays to ban AR-15s. So if they're not going to make any changes, you know, then I think that something like this is good. Fine, hit them where it hurts. If the tourism industry gets hurt, if we do this walkout, if we, you know, do these kids, I'm so proud of them for speaking out and calling these things out, because something does need to get done. And if their own representatives are not going to do anything, then I think we do have to start taking our own fate
into
our hands.
And it circles back to our, you know, talking to Nicole. Like, again, these are people that experienced one specific instance in this, like, monstrosity of a system, you know, and they're bringing it again back down to the human level. Like, that I was there, you know, they were there, etc. So it's pretty it's exciting to see them almost immediately jumping into action, you know. I mean, obviously, like, doing things is sometimes a way to deal with grief, but it's really interesting. And so some other things that are happening in the gun control world is Walmart says it's going to raise age restrictions to 21 for gun purchases, remove items assembling assault rifles from the website. There's an article on CNBC about that, amongst other sites. And then also Dick's Sporting Goods on
Go
Wednesday.
Dick.
The chief executive officer, Edward Stack, said that stores will stop selling assault rifles and high-capacity magazines and will no longer sell guns to anyone under the age of 21. And it's interesting, there's an article in CNN Money. The title is, "Dick's Sporting Goods expected backlash but got flowers instead."
That's awesome.
And so, you know, it's nice to see larger corporations making a stance too, you know, like TikTok finally. But
and it's funny because you do see the expected response of, well, I'm never shopping at Dick's again, and then
everybody else is like, I didn't even buy sporting goods, but now I'm inspired.
But now
I'm gonna go buy a fucking basketball.
If that was the deal breaker for you, that they're not selling, you know, weapons literally meant to hurt and kill, and it's like, then I think your priorities might just be a little bit out.
Sure.
You know, like, again, we've circled back to this so many times. No one's trying to take away your guns.
Yeah.
But we do need to rein it in this country. We have a problem and we need to address it. And I'm glad that Walmart and Dick's and many other companies,
Delta, United,
especially those that have divested from the NRA. You know, this is great. These are the kinds of steps we need to take. Now, obviously, the bigger step, legislation.
Well, the Georgia legislature removed Delta's tax break for jet fuel. Delta is based in Georgia.
That's where I'm from.
Well, this is not a thing to be proud of, but
I'm just proud of, I just Georgia though.
But yeah, they removed the tax break. So now Delta no longer has a tax break for jet fuel that they use coming from Georgia. Do you know how many people used the NRA discount, which they discontinued? 13 people.
13 people
used it. Crazy. And now Delta will probably leave Georgia.
Oh, man.
Anywho.
Drones help bring back electricity to Puerto Rico.
How cool is that? This is an article.
Drugs or drones? It sounded like you said drugs.
It did sound like you said drugs. But this is really cool. It's an article in Wired, which is a publication I love. But it's written by Eric Adams. And basically, right now in Puerto Rico, there are still hundreds of thousands of citizens that continue to suffer through power outages, etc. And so it's interesting that drones are subbing in for really tedious, imprecise, the article says, tedious, imprecise, dangerous, and usually very human process. Like ordinarily, the company that's utilizing drones, the name is Duke Energy. The workers would like trudge through tropical islands and mountain forests and its ravines and gorges to find dropped power lines and attach the rediscovered ones to light and string based projectile. And it's like super exciting, you know, because that is not only like a physically challenging thing. I mean, these workers would, you know, it says 13 day shifts from sunup to sundown, and were able to sub in this new technology to help do it a little faster and more precise, which is so super cool. So shall we do
our candidate to get excited about? So focusing on Florida again. So there already is the incumbent Bill Nelson, also a Democrat, but I would like to focus on Tamika Lyles. All right. So she was born in Jackson, Tennessee, raised by a single mother. But she herself, Tamika is a very smart and bright individual. So at 15, she had the opportunity to take a class for students preparing to enter medical fields. And after taking the Tennessee State Board exam, she passed as the youngest certified nursing assistant in the program's history. During her sophomore and junior year, she volunteered as a pre-med student and in the county's largest public hospital. And then she also graduated from high school a year early, pursued an undergraduate degree at Lambeth University. Because of that, she changed her focus to pre-med, from pre-med to law. She graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Sociology. So she's really smart. Served in the Air Force. She toured United States and Germany with her three sons. Like, just as a person, she's just badass. All right. So, but some things that she's focused on, she has a lot of, she definitely wants to help out with the gun issue back in Florida. So her idea, again, as we were talking before, like she's not trying to take away guns, but she wants to help with legislation. So reform that.
It's like what Jennifer said the other week. She was like, it's not, you know, it's not about necessarily repealing the Second Amendment, but it's about like safe practices.
Absolutely. She is also focusing on reconstructing the criminal justice system. So she says that taxpayers are making too large a contribution to the prison system. She firmly believes that by deploying reforms that decrease the spending while also ensuring public safety, they are key to changing the American prison system through the activation and support of better resources, i.e. mental health treatment, job training. We can work together to decrease the rates of recidivism that harm not only those in the prison system, but their neighbors and families as well. She has a wonderful website and that you can also contribute to her as well if you are so interested. So visit her at lylesforsenate.com. That's L-Y-L-E-S for senate.com. And give Tamika Lyles a look. All right. So that's our candidate.
Nicole Dalton's coming up next.
Yes, Nicole Dalton's coming up next. So stick around, guys. We will be right back.
Hey, y'all, we're back with our guest. I'm so excited. We have Nicole Dalton on today, who is not only one of my nearest and dearest friends, who we frequently refer to as Goddess. She is also an actress, a comic, and an advocate, and she lives and thrives, I might say, with systemic juvenile rheumatoid arthritis. Mm-hmm. And is an advocate ambassador with the National Arthritis Research Foundation and Creaky Joints. And we could keep going, but let's just talk to her.
Hello, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
Yay! It's so exciting.
You're so excited.
I am really excited.
We're all very excited, but you're like a beam of light over there.
I know.
I love you so much.
Because I love her.
Yes. And it's so cool because we were talking earlier how Peter Morley, we had him on the podcast, and it was such an informative interview with him. And now you're going through your own journey and kind of going through a similar battle with health and the healthcare industry. Mm-hmm. And so just go ahead and kind of inform us about what you have and what you've been going through since your diagnosis.
Well, I was diagnosed with onset systemic juvenile rheumatoid arthritis when I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. And I had a really acute presentation. I had fevers of 105 degrees, a rash. All of my joints were really swollen. I couldn't move. Sometimes I couldn't breathe. I had pericarditis, which is swelling around your heart. It feels like a horse is kicking you in your chest. And this is right when I turned 13. So I thought that's what becoming a woman was. You know, I had no narrative for what was happening to me. And I had a really quick diagnosis because my presentation came on so quickly. I was hospitalized and I had a false positive for Lyme's disease, which delayed my diagnosis a little bit, but not too long. But there were no drugs available for what I had at the time. Now there are a lot of options. I went on prednisone, which is a steroid. They call it the devil's Tic Tacs.
Oh, wow.
in our posse that we run in, because it causes weight gain, psychoses. It's like putting a Band-Aid on a dam that is holding back the ocean, because it puts your symptoms under control. But I threw my brother into a front door, and I was 13.
Wow,
that's how crazy it can make you. And I gained between 16 and 20 pounds. I was 13 years old, and it makes your hair fall out on your head. Some grow on your face. It's really an insane drug. So that's my bottom line of a drug I won't go on. Mm-hmm. But now there are so many more available, and it's a cyclical disease. So you can go into remission for no reason at all and think, oh, this disease is gone. And then it can randomly flare up. So I think that sometimes feeds into, this alternative therapy worked for me. And then you have a flare up and it puts the burden back on the patient of thinking, what did I do wrong? Mm-hmm. When it's just the pattern of the disease itself. Mm-hmm. It's natural. That's what happens. But now there are biologic medications. Some of them are called Enbrel, Humira, Remicade, Simponi. And then JAK, Jax kinase inhibitors, one of them is Xeljanz, and they work in a completely a different way. They're TNF inhibitors, and they have changed the game. So the deformities that I have, most people who are 5 to 10 years younger than I am, won't have that. And they are the preferred form of treatment. Mm. You want to get on them, in my opinion, as quickly as possible. And sometimes our healthcare system has something called step therapy, which doesn't allow you to get to those treatments because they are more expensive as fast. So you are expected to fail first on something like prednisone, something cheaper, because you have that barrier in your health insurance plan, and you have to fail on chemotherapy, methotrexate, which is what I take. I take it once a week. Before you can get to a biologic, and it could take months. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, your body is disintegrating. Meanwhile, your joints are deteriorating. Meanwhile, you're getting sicker and sicker and sicker. While if you had the access to a biologic, which should be a decision made between you and your physician, you could. It was literally overnight when I took Enbrel. It was a miracle. Not all patients are going to experience that, but Enbrel got me through college.
Right. Mm-hmm. Now, for our listeners, will you describe a little bit, you know, you started, you had your onset or presentation but you've gone through these different cycles. And so will you explain how arthritis, you know, hinders, I don't know if that's weird, hinders your movement and then attacks other systems in your body.
Right. It's called comorbidities.
Yeah. So. Yeah. What is that?
You just aren't throwing these terms around.
That's like a great word, but what is it?
So if you want to win, if you want to be a winner like me, you get onset systemic JIA, because systemic means it attacks or has the potential to attack multiple organ systems, which it has for me. So my digestive system wanted to get in on the party a few years ago, and it just stopped functioning. I couldn't digest food. Doctors were mystified. I had false they thought it was in my head. I was like, no, my stomach's distended, and I look about 5 months pregnant. I'm pretty sure this isn't in my head. So I went back to New York where my base doctors are, and they had found that they needed to remove a section of my large intestines and that my small intestines had fallen. And then there were a whole bunch of other things when they opened me up. And so it can attack just different, similar to lupus, and it can go after different parts of your body and have cognitive effects too. Migraines, or you just get something called brain fog, which is your brain isn't inflamed. It's just, it's as if you're trying to think through fog. You have trouble word recall. See, that's an example. Yeah. That's a perfect example of it. And it doesn't happen every day. But it's harder to get up in the morning. The fatigue is, it says you're walking around feeling like you have the flu just every day. And some days it's worse than others. And the pain, I liken it to if someone had shot you in the hand with a nail gun and then you knew it was going to happen maybe three more times that day, but you didn't know when. So you're just walking around as if you had the flu. And you knew you already had a nail had already gone through one of your hands, and you knew you were going to have three more strikes that day. But, and then you have to do everything an adult does.
Yeah. I'm blown away too by, you mentioned a couple of times, like having to prove it to doctors.
Yeah. That's proof of your pain.
Wild to me that it's multiple times, like talking about insurance companies, and then you have to prove your pain to physicians. And I'm just blown away that there's no, the base root of being a doctor isn't like, okay, cool, I believe you. Like,
it's wild. Well, you can get, so there's something called your SED rate, R factor. There are blood tests that can show that you have this disease, but I'm something called R factor negative, which is incredible because obviously I have the disease. You could look at my hands, and I'm lucky that my hands are reformed. So I'm not criminalized when I go to the pharmacy and I need opioids to survive, to get through my day. Otherwise, and I don't say this lightly, I would have killed myself long ago. And I'm brave enough to sit here and say that. And I have other, we call each other spoonies, but that's a whole other story. Other chronic pain survivors, or we live with it, who have said the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's intolerable. It is an intolerable way to live. And that is why opioids were created. We are the people that need them to survive. Mm-hmm. I'm sitting here. I didn't need one this morning, so I didn't take it. I don't think it's a different, it's not an addictive thing when you need them. Mm-hmm. And I'm lucky when I go to the pharmacy, like I said, they see my hand, so I don't have to prove it. Whereas some of my other friends, they have to prove their pain on top of feeling the way they feel, which is outrageous. And every, you know, piece I see in the news where it's an opioid epidemic and, you know, it's on the right, it makes me insane because they have done no, they haven't interviewed anyone who lives the way I live. No other patient, no one in the cancer community or lupus community or SJIA community has been interviewed. And it's really hard to get an opioid prescription now. They're a Schedule II drug. You know, sometimes when they say it's so easy to get these drugs, I'd love some names and numbers.
Yeah.
Because it is really hard. It's not easy.
Right.
Even with my rheumatologist, I don't know what they're talking about. You know, heroin, maybe it's easier to get heroin, which I'm not looking for, but it's hard. Mm.
Yeah.
And so now, you know, you're facing the issue of cost. So so now you've got this disease that it needs constant attention. You need to monitor it. You need to have doctor's visits. You need to have medicine to control it. And yet the American pharmaceutical industry has kind of created this horrible system,
yes,
where you are literally paying exorbitant amounts of money just to stay alive. Mm-hmm. And you're lucky if you have that money. So what are you mentioned pharmaceutical benefit managers.
Right.
You want to talk about this a little bit so yes, we can understand what that system is.
Right. So I have health insurance, and one of my drugs was $32,000 a shot. And
so that's for like one dose.
That was one dose.
Yeah. $32,000.
Yes. $32,000. Oh, it was a little over $32,000. And I actually have a bill from them right now, even though I had had previous doses, because they didn't, my doctors failed to show medical necessity for this drug, even though I had had previous doses of right, it. And you have to go into the doctor's office to get that injection because it's so expensive. They want to make sure you're doing it correctly. Your doctor has to give it to them. Mm-hmm. So all of these biologics are very expensive. And so what we have created is a drug company comes out with a drug. And research and development people who are in drug companies, they are in it to create drugs that are helping people. They are good. They're good people. They are good. They have good intentions. Then we are paying for the list price of a drug. You would never go in to buy a car and expect to pay the sticker price for a car, but we are paying the list prices for our drugs. So you may go into a Rite Aid and it may be cheaper for you to pay cash than to use your insurance plan, but they're not allowed to tell you that because of gag clauses, because they are contracted with certain insurance companies. So you should know that. So you sometimes ask. Then they, so drug comes out, then the wholesalers get involved. And then there's something called pharmaceutical benefit managers who believe that they're acting in our best interest by looking at scientific data and saying, okay, this drug, will lower costs for patients. And they directly influence the price of a drug because the drug companies have to bid to get onto something called a formulary. And to get on a formulary, they have to offer a rebate, which is a kickback of something like 20% to the health insurance companies. I'm sorry, the pharmaceutical companies, in order to get on a health insurance company's drug
offering list.
Yeah. So yeah, for me, it's something called step therapy, or it would be a biologic. So initially these rebates were supposed to lower our copays. I mean, has your copay ever been lowered in your life? Have you?
I've never experienced a copay lower.
So then what happens, now what they say is, okay, if you give us 40%, we'll not only make sure you are the number one drug on the formulary, we'll make sure your competitor isn't even allowed on it. So that's the kind of the system we've gotten ourselves into. And there's really no one person at fault. That's just that's just what the system looks like. Mm-hmm. And another thing that happens is when you go to something like a mom and pop pharmacy, they are not attached to this whole dynamic. So it's really important that we support them. The national community of pharmacists are crusaders against this, and ATAP, I suggest you Google them. So the main PBMs are Express Scripts, CVS Caremark, and Optimum Rx. And it's just to be aware of how the machine itself really works. And there's no oversight.
That's crazy to me that they get kicked off the list for, I mean, some drugs are getting kicked off the list basically for financial reasons.
Yes.
For the companies.
Yeah.
And so like what happens if your choice drug is not on the list?
Well, sometimes what they do is they have coupons. So you need, let's say you need a biologic that is not the preferred drug, but it's still offered. So what they'll do is they will, because that drug company still needs to stay on the list to stay relevant, they'll offer a coupon. So let's say I need a biologic. It's still on the list. They'll offer, because your copay would be $3,000 a month. So they'll offer you a coupon to pay that $3,000. But you have to have the insurance to get that coupon, any to get the otherwise
to start.
Yeah,
yeah.
If you didn't have insurance, you just die. You just That'd don't get it. But there are, is a grassroots, there's a grassroots group happening that we are getting samples for drugs and hoarding them. And let's say there's a gap in your insurance policy. So maybe theoretically, I would have some extra Humira or extra Kineret or extra whatever. And so maybe I could possibly get it to you until you could get your Humira, until you failed on a drug. And so maybe there is a group of us who are starting to do that because the system isn't working, because right. people are dying.
So is there now, I mean, big picture, like politically speaking, is there a push for something like single payer, or is there too much regulation within the market? Because what you mentioned about the opioid crisis is something that surprised me. I've never heard that perspective on it. So I'm curious, from the community that you're working with, is what is the opinion on big picture health insurance markets of the future?
I think a single payer system is really tricky because, as I've said, these biologics are the future, and they're what everybody's talking about because they're the biggest money makers, and they're very expensive. So my friends who have what I have, who are on what is this Medi-Cal in will have to be on the phone for hours and hours to get their drugs approved. And it's really hard for them to get their biologic sometimes. And then someone like Peter, I know it does save lives. So everybody needs health insurance. That's the bottom line. That is that's non-negotiable. However, there needs to be, I would want to see a plan that says it is between you and your physician. It's a conversation that you have access to the drugs you need, and that is also non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. So it needs to be thoroughly vetted. It can't be, the government can't have a say on what drugs you have access to. It can't be limited. And those are the fears that I would have big picture wise for a single payer system. There are great insurance plans out there. We just need to make them more accessible to everyone. Mm-hmm. And more affordable to everyone.
Yeah.
And we live in a capitalistic society. So, you know, this $32,000 drug that came out, the more things you can get this drug, the more things you can get it, I'm missing the word, but it was only you could only use it for one disease. It was for a Muckles-Wilk syndrome, which is a fever disease. But now it was approved for SJIA. So the more things that you can use the drug for, the price is supposed to come down. And that didn't happen for this drug. Mm-hmm. So when a drug's patent runs out, you can use generics. And then generics are so much cheaper. So we're starting to get into biosimilars with biologics. And that's a huge, huge debate in our community too, because these are biologic medications. They're not biosimilars. They're a completely different drug. Mm-hmm. So if you've been on biologics for a long time, you can't just be switched to a biosimilar. If you've never taken a biologic ever, maybe biosimilars would be a good choice for you. So you see how it's such a gray area. It's just not a black and white conversation, because they could, biosimilars would be a great option, but you can't then just switch someone who's been on Humira or Enbrel and it's been working for them onto a biosimilar because it's cheaper. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated conversation. So does that answer your question?
Yes.
What that looks like?
I was curious about that because, again, like I said before, I was surprised by your thoughts and words about the opioid epidemic. So I was like, I wonder how single payer healthcare plays into this, because healthcare is such a convoluted place. Mm-hmm. And we were talking earlier about like Martin Shkreli buying drugs and raising prices and lowering prices and how that affects markets. And so, I was just curious your thoughts on that.
We all want to demonize. We live in a very litigious society. We all want to demonize one entity of this system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's not one conglomerate's fault. We have to look at the whole machine, and that's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
But you're actually taking steps to, tack away at that machine. Mm-hmm. You're involved in so many groups and organizations. So just tell us about like what you've been doing and how you've taken this disease and you've kind of made a movement and you're leading a fight to get some sort of reform and make sure that people do have the accessibility to these drugs and can afford it. Yeah, what are you up to?
Yeah, so after part of my intestines were removed, I took a
sentence I will probably never have to say.
Probably. I took a stand-up class, and it turned out into a thing that I became. So all of my stand-up surrounds my illness or surrounds my use of opioids, and I go into pharmaceutical companies and I do my act, or I'm the MC for the Meet the Scientist Gala for the National Arthritis Research Foundation. This year I was their patient speaker last year, and I raise awareness for this disease, because awareness leads to funding. There's no billboard for Still's disease, and my intention would be it would be Comedy for a Cure. I hosted that this year. We need money. We need funding, because mm-hmm. we need a cure. We don't need any more expensive Band-Aids. So I, through my comedy and through speaking my truth, through just living and telling people, yes, I'm living with this. I'm not suffering through this. And I still have value, just because maybe I haven't reached certain marks that my peers have made, buying a house, doing this, I still have value as a person. And I have a group of friends that really, you know, especially my Sweaty Sundays tribe, mm-hmm. I really feel that they see the wholeness of me. And that, and I think the way we view disabled people, that whole conversation has to change too. It's really protecting the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, HR 620. That's something that was just, it's going to Senate now, which is it's getting that far is insane. It puts the burden on the patients. And you need to call your senators, everyone, whether you live in a blue or a red state, to say no to HR 620. You can do a Google on that, because that's a whole other conversation. So I'm actively working on just calling and raising awareness on that bill. And just leading by example, really, and getting as much awareness out about this disease, the effects it has, and how getting to the more aggressive treatment first would actually save money in the long run in our society in every way. Mm-hmm. So that's how you really... really save money, and that there's nothing wrong with being disabled, that you can be, you know, they would talk about the wounded healer. And I find that everybody wants the person on the couch that has come through, that has overcome. That's the inspiration. Well, I can be my most healthy self while still having a chronic illness. Mm-hmm. And there's maybe nothing to fix. Maybe I can work on being as healthy as I can while living with this, and you don't have to fix me, because people always want to find a cure with me, you know, offer me a cure, an alternative therapy cure, and that's fine. But I mainly want to be seen as whole as I am, no matter what. And that's my biggest challenge.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah. I love that. And also I will say, you're a very funny stand up.
Oh,
I've seen you perform.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Highly recommend.
Five stars.
Thank you. I don't feel like I was that funny today. But
okay. I have a question. I feel like, you know, more than most, you have an incredible understanding of your health. And that happened because it had to. Mm. But I'm curious, how do you balance like holding all that information in your brain and then the financial pressures of that, and then, you know, not necessarily always being able to work because you're in a flare up. Like, how do you, what's the spark each day to, you know, keep pushing through to the other side?
Well, I don't manage it well all the time. I always believed in magic as a kid, and that never went away when I got sick. It's my friends. It's my community. I always wanted a magical community of friends that danced, that believed in magic and had great imaginations. And my fiance and my family's an incredible mm-hmm. support system. And my acting and comedy, that's really, I can't get out of bed every day. So I can't say that's what gets me out of bed every day, but that's what keeps me alive.
Yeah.
And it's not easy to live with this. It really isn't. It can get very dark. And I think you kind of make peace. You have to make peace with, you know, I went back to school to pursue my master's in psychotherapy. So you have to make peace with, all right, so I'm going to have to go to the bottom of the well. Do I want to, you know, try to drown? Am I going to drown every time, or am I going to learn to float? So how do you want to make peace with every time you have to go down to the bottom of the well? And that's what I've had to learn to do. And sometimes I do it well, and sometimes I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you've remained so strong and positive in ways that are like, even just the half hour we've spoken to you, I'm already inspired immensely. And so so thank you so much for just, you know, you channeled what it can be a lot of pain and a lot of stress. And you said, I'm going to do something about it. And you did it in so many avenues. Like, you're also doing stand-up, like, just to make people laugh. You know, you're giving yourself to others, you know, and it still fulfills you in a way. And that's really beautiful to see. So thank you so much.
Oh, it's my honor
for doing that. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think a couple things, you know, I think you're a wealth of information.
This is the most informative.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, for sure. We've had a lot of informative guests on. Yeah. But I was like, wow.
Yeah.
No, in a good way. In a good way. You present the information in a very palatable way.
Understandable way. Yeah. Which is so important to our listeners, that it's like, you know, not all of our listeners have arthritis, you know, but understanding, like, you're an example of a specific type of disease that's operating within the system. And politically, we have to take a look. We have to reevaluate the system all the time. Mm-hmm. Like, we have to always be on our toes as individuals that live in America, because the system's always slowly shifting, and again, at no fault of anyone necessarily, but we have to be aware of that. So I think that's a good takeaway. So I'm sad we have to wrap, because there's so much more information I'm sure you have to share. But for everyone listening, you can follow Nicole on Instagram at Nicole Allison Dalton. You can follow the National Arthritis Research Foundation at Cure Arthritis. And their gala's on March
23rd.
March 23rd.
You can donate. You can attend.
You can buy tickets. It's in Newport Beach.
Yes.
Close
nice.
By.
Nice.
Yeah. Did you say the website? Sorry.
Curearthritis.org.
Great. Sorry.
And then Creaky Joints is another organization we didn't really touch on, but you're involved with.
Yes, I'm involved with them. They're fabulous. They have tons of resources, tons of information, and a great health, a lot of information about the healthcare
industry.
System.
Yeah. And then you can find us on Apple Podcasts, on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at We Rule Podcast. You can email us. We really love getting emails.
Yeah,
we respond. Rate us and give us a little rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. We enjoy that.
Share it with
also,
your friends.
Also, make sure to call your senator at 202-224-3121. That's the switchboard. And tell them to not go for H.R. 620.
Timely.
You have to call. Everything makes a difference. Nicole, thank you so much for coming on.
It's my honor. Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
Yes. All right. We'll see you all next week.
Hey, what's up? I'm Caitlin, and I host a podcast on the What's a Creative Network called Lizard People. Every week, I invite a guest on to argue their favorite conspiracy theory. And along the way, we have some good old-fashioned laughs. So if you like laughing and conspiracy theories and having a good time, come listen to Lizard People. Okay, see you later. Bye.